This is Application Paranoia, Season 4, Episode 2. So welcome again to Application Paranoia, our podcast dedicated to application security, DevSecOps, and AppScan. I'm Colin Bell, and joining me are my well-informed colleagues, Rob Cuddy and Chris Dewar. In this episode, we're very excited to also be joined by John Dixon, who is a renowned expert in the AppSec world. We will have a lot to hear from him, but for now, hey Rob, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm having fun, glad to be here. It was tournament time, so that was always good. A lot of college basketball over the last few weeks or so, and watching all the craziness. And it was great because for only the second time, you had a number 16 seed team take out a number one seed. And so it was just several weeks of watching things unfold that you didn't expect. And so that's always really fun.
And all the brackets that died that day.
Yes. What was funny, there was, so every year, right, they do millions of brackets, and somehow ESPN's able to track it. By the end of I think it was either the second day or maybe the third day, right? So the first weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you've got two rounds. But somewhere in that space, there was no longer a perfect bracket left. And that was the first time in a while.
So everyone's brackets got jacked. We're all terrible at guessing.
It was amazing. Well, when Arizona lost, right, they were a 2 seed, so they lost to a 15. So they lost, and then when Purdue went down the next day, that was basic. That destroyed everything.
Yeah. The nail in the coffin.
Thankfully, I'm not a gambling guy on that kind of stuff. I do it for. Yeah, it was crazy to watch. Of course, it was sad in my house. I mentioned, I think, on a previous episode, my daughter and I, right, and how I've raised a child who is as excited about it as me. Well, school lost on Thursday, and mine lost on Friday, so it was like a really sad weekend for us that way. But it was still a great tournament.
So speaking of winning, have you been winning, Chris? What's been happening?
Oh, yeah, playing disc golf, doing pretty good. My latest tournament, I think I was in the bottom half, so not as good as I would like it to be. But, having fun. Played in the rain on one day, played in wind on day two. It was crazy, crazy tough day, crazy tough tournament. But I did find something out in, believe it of all places, a finance book that I was just blown away by. And he was kind of talking about Tails and how Tails sometimes change our world for the better. When we talk about Tails, like Microsoft that came from nowhere and became this huge, huge thing, or Amazon, or, Tesla, or some of the other companies that realistically, at the beginning, you never would have guessed they're going to be where they're going to be. But what we're going to talk about is a man who is a little bit of a tail thinker. He didn't go with the conventional wisdom, but in the late 1800s, there was a doctor who noticed a correlation between people with syphilis and fevers that got better. So he had this brilliant idea to induce fevers in people who had syphilis. And this is before antibiotics, so none of that stuff's available, mind you. So people just had this and they're like, oh my God, I'm gonna die. And that's what it did. It killed people. It's like a bacterial infection in a bad, bad place, in the no-no square. So so ultimately, this guy took a mild form of malaria and he started something called fever pathology or fever treatment. And he injected him with malaria. Dude saved people. I mean, he killed people, of course, because it's malaria. You're injecting a deadly disease to help fight this other deadly disease. And it worked. He managed. He actually got the Nobel Prize for Medicine. It actually worked. It's like, talk about out of your mind thinking at the time. I just thought it was a fascinating story. Like, you cured syphilis with malaria? What are you going to use to cure the malaria? Typhoid? So it's like, but no, because it was a low strain, eventually he figured out how to do it, quote unquote, properly to kill fewer people. But it was like 3 out of 10 would be cured of this particular disease on their own, But when he got done, I guess it was around 6 out of 10. So, you know, there's a lot of people that I guess sang his praises back in the day for thinking outside the box and just noticing a pattern and quote unquote being a tail person, something that nobody saw coming.
Yeah,
which is fascinating to me. You know, this is, again, no antibiotics. You can't just go to the doctor and be like, give me my amoxicillin or whatever. No, you're going to be like, go to the doctor. Can I have my malaria shot, please? Thank you. No questions asked. Yeah. It's like, what? Why do you need a malaria shot, sir? This is a don't ask, don't tell office, right? Yeah, would you like to try our milder scurvy to induce fevers? But yeah, that's a thing apparently.
So last week was the 1st of April, so we're into April now. But I don't know if you read about the worst April Fool's joke of 2023. Did you?
Oh, we got to hear it.
No, so. The Royal Mail in the UK, someone put up a post for them that all the staff on Saturday, which was April the 1st, were getting an 11% pay rise backdated to April 2022 with an agreement from the workers' unions. And, of course, everyone got very excited and found out that, no, we're not. It's an April Fool's.
That's a crappy April Fool's joke. You've won the lottery. Psych. JK or whatever they say these days. Oh, my God. You can't believe anything you see on April Fool's. I mean, I saw so many videos, and I had to knee-jerk because they were so believable. I was like, that's not real. Aliens aren't real. They're not coming from the mothership. And you go and you look for news articles, there's nothing.
They had to apologize. They said, we apologize for any caused upset or miss from our misjudged April Fool's joke.
How do they think that would be funny? I mean, come on. That's terrible.
Yeah.
Like the monolith in the middle of the desert. That's a funny April Fool's joke if it was an April Fool's joke. This, not so good.
No, you don't mess with people's money.
It's like... No, you really don't. God, tone deaf.
So we've also been on the road a bit, and in the last month I was in Sydney last week, and prior to that we were in Florida. Our last episode, as you know, was at the Agile conference in Florida. But at the same event, we also chatted to a good few folks at our booth, and I think it's a good spot to sort of share some of those thoughts with you. So Rob, maybe you can put some context on. One of those people that we talked to, and we can play the, you know, what we discovered. You know?
Yeah. So we did. You and I had a chance to be at the Agile International Conference in Miami, and we took advantage of being able to do the live podcast. So we invited a few folks to come over to the booth and talk. One of the ones that we were really excited about was Stephanie Sylvester, who was a startup founder for a bunch of corporates and nonprofits, and was there talking on a panel around women in tech. So we brought her over to the booth, and we asked her really about how people could better advocate for women in tech, and particularly how men could do that. And she had some great insight and tips for us.
So, hey guys, we're here at the Agile International Conference, and we have Stephanie with us. And Stephanie, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
So my name is Stephanie Sylvester, and I'm a co-founder of Avatar Buddy. Avatar Buddy uses AI to help people be the best version of themselves.
Wow. So there's a whole lot going on with AI today,
yes.
Right? But Stephanie, the question I want to ask you just came out of a great panel discussion on women in technology and women in Agile and things like that. And it occurred to me that there are a lot of folks who want to advocate, and there's a lot of men who want to be advocates. But the question I would like to ask you is, for men, how do you really want us to advocate for you? So instead of us figuring it out ourselves, what are some of the best ways a man can advocate for a woman in tech today?
So I have a lot of great examples because I have wonderful suite of champions and mentors that are men. I think the first thing is to start at home. So if you have daughters, how are you interacting with your daughters? How are you interacting with your wife if you have a wife? Are you supportive? Are you truly supportive? Are you encouraging? Are you listening to them? Because if you hear them, if you can hear your daughters, you can hear your wife, then you can be an advocate for women in the workplace. The second piece about it is when you're there, I think you start being a champion first. So if you see an employee that's on your team that's doing great, maybe, or even if they're struggling a little bit, reaching out to them, understanding what they're doing. And then when you are in rooms where they're not, advocating for them, because you advocating for them just builds up their credibility and their political capital way more than if they have to advocate for themselves. And then giving them opportunities to grow. So making sure, like, if you find something about leadership conference or something like that, encouraging them to go to it. And then I think also, like, just coming to conferences, not being afraid of being the only male or a handful of male in the room, because that's where you really get to hear. And I think the other piece of it is just not being afraid, like not making this be one more thing that you do, but that this is just part of your DNA. This is how you work, right? So you're like, you're looking at everybody and you're saying, I want to elevate women, but I want to elevate everybody.
Exactly.
So if I have a team of 10 people and 4 women and 6 are men, you're elevating all 10 of them, but you might have to be a little bit more intentional with the women. You might have to spend a little bit more energy because women might be a little bit less shy, more shy. And so that's your whole DNA is, I want to grow my staff. I want to develop my staff. I want the best thing to happen to my staff, and when I'm the proudest, is when people are trying to hire my staff members that knows that I've crushed it. And I'm saying all 10 of them need to be hired away, and I am spending maybe a little bit more energy on the women, but it's everything.
Yes, that was, yeah, I mean, that's brilliant. You know, it's very insightful. You know, we must try and get Stephanie to maybe come on as a guest in the future. Yeah,
so. Exactly. Yeah, no, I think I would really love to unpack with it. Lily had some great things to say about mentorship. I particularly just really liked her comment about just showing up, right? Particularly that if you are a dad of a young girl, you need to show up for them when they're, it gives them confidence to show up in the workplace later. So those kinds of things, and just really being able to provide space and provide opportunity to grow.
Excellent.
Well, friends, we are delighted to have with us for this episode, John Dixon. John Dixon, if you don't know, is an internationally recognized security evangelist and keynote speaker, also an author and inventor. Who's advised organizations on matters around cybersecurity risk for over 25 years. John was a principal at the Denham Group, where he successfully helped with an acquisition by Coalfire in 2021. He served in Desert Storm as an Air Force Intelligence Officer, and following that in Air Force Information Warfare Center as a member of the Air Force Computer Emergency Response Team. And since the Air Force, he's done a lot of client-facing roles with companies like Trident, KPMG, SecureLogix, Denham Group, and Coalfire. He's also the chairman of the San Antonio's Air System Development Committee and Mayor Ron Nuremberg's Blue Ribbon Task Force that's supporting the development of a world-class airport facility in San Antonio, which I'm also excited to ask about. So, John, first, thank you so much for your service. We appreciate that immensely, all of the things. And those of us old enough to remember the Desert Storm days know how important that was. So we're really grateful for that. And we're excited to be able to talk to you. So curious, one of the big things how you're doing first, and then one of the things we're hearing a lot about these days is kind of the software supply chain and the need around securing that kind of thing. So I'm curious what you think about what the software supply chain actually is and why this is becoming so important.
Well, it's way more than S-bombs. I'll just start by saying that. You know, exactly. I think we got a little help year before last, when the White House started working on the, you know, their executive order. They published that in, I guess it would have been April of 2021, although the years blur post-COVID. I thought that was a big shot in the arm, as a matter of fact, to us. But if you go back and read that section 4 of the executive order, it has very prescriptive requirements for DoD and government purchasing, which I thought was great. But the challenge is that really that's simply not enough. And I think that Rob, you and I were at a conference last fall where I did a presentation where I said S-bombs are, simply not enough. That's the least we could do. And so what I really feel is it's part of a larger business challenge that we have right now where, I mean, everybody is either a consumer of or producer of software right now. And, post SolarWinds, post, almost whatever breach of the day is, there's a much more acute awareness by executives, non-technical executives, about risk associated with software. And what I say though is that it is really a bigger understanding of what your buyers are requiring. And that's the truth, right? It, regardless of what governments say and regulation compliance, it's really what your big buyers, what your big buyers are asking you for, because that's going to drive behavior more than anything. But it's not only the upward facing supply chain requirements, it's the downward facing, I'd say, your own supply chain that you have, including just open source software, whatever you consume. And a lot of times where I hear organizations talk about it, it's one dimensional. It's either, again, up channel to their buyers, think of federal government and federal contractor is a great example, or it's, purely internal, where they're worried about the software that they consume, either from other vendors or from open source components, et cetera. So it's a much broader, top down, bottom up view of how software is consumed, used, and then sold, so to speak. And if you start to look at it that way, again, then S-bombs become just part of that and not the only thing, if that makes sense. Hmm.
Yeah, and I appreciated that conversation at the event we were at. That's, I attended the session largely because I was so intrigued by the title. It was that S-bombs, it's the least we can do. I think the other thing I hear a lot in that space is just API security. And so I wonder, right, if people are thinking just, hey, if I have a good S-bomb and I do a good job with my APIs, then I'm good to go, right?
Again, I wish that were easy. I mean, you can look at SolarWinds. I mean, that was really a software release problem and software production problem. You can have source code problems. You can have, you name it, challenges. So those are just two facets of it. And, I think some of the senior application security experts understand this. But again, a lot of the particulars get kind of washed out when it goes up channel. I want to go back to the S-bombs, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
Because I think the metaphors that we use or have been used previously are not apt anymore. This idea that we're, the S-bombs are like components that we put together as part of a recipe when we bake something, the chocolate chip component where you have, ingredients, and then you have like the chocolate chips that are made from somebody else, so you don't really understand that. All these metaphors we're trying to use. I tried to explain this in a different way, in saying with S-bombs and software risk in general, you have what I called a pantry problem. Like you have all these ingredients in a pantry. You have all these food products, all these, perishables or unperishables, whatever, you have them in a pantry. You find out on a Tuesday that a particular ingredient is now carcinogenic. Suddenly the Food and Drug Administration or the equivalent in each country comes out and says, oh my gosh, you can't use this additive anymore. It causes cancer. So what I'm saying about when I use the term pantry problem, I mean, suddenly you walk in the pantry and say, where is this particular ingredient in all of the pieces of food and different things that I've got? And that's a different problem than like the making a cookie where you're doing it in a finite time. It's pretty straightforward, all these different things. But this is an issue where if you are, look at OpenSSL when shell shock happened like way, way long time ago, or Log4j, suddenly you're looking at the same time at everything and where it lives. And those are moments in time where you really have, if you don't have your act together, it is a entirely manual and laborious process. So, you know, look at it that way. As a point in time, suddenly I need to know where this particular component or ingredient, whatever you want to call it, but where does it exist in everything that's in your pantry or in your storehouse or whatever? And that is more, I think, what happens in reality. Whatever the next big component vulnerability is, it'll be this precise moment when, by the way, unless you're a developer, you don't know what all these, you know, components are. And I did this little thing at an OWASP presentation and then at an ISSA presentation. I asked how many people knew what Log4j was before Log4j came out vulnerable. And at OWASP, right, everybody put their hand up. If you go to ISSA, nobody knew what it was before. Those are the security people, you know? So like, unless you're a Java developer, if you use it component, but the problem that we have around, again, supply chain in general, is when this happens, whatever it is, either component or supplier or some component, you drop everything and you find out where it resides throughout all of the software that you have. And that is an enormously difficult challenge and mostly manual at this point.
So John, that kind of leads me to the question I was going to ask is, who do you see these days as being responsible for the security of or SBOMs? Is it still the security team that is looking at it, or do you think the dev teams are now taking a little bit more responsibility?
I would say in the more mature organizations, the dev teams, and the ones that are just getting started, probably the security teams at this point. That's a broad statement. I don't think there's a single point of entry or single point of responsibility. That's part of the challenge. So, you know, if you go back 20 or 30 years ago, there wasn't anything known as a CISO. There's a VP of IT or security or something like that. So, mm-hmm. So at least in some of the naming conventions, we've got that part done. But like, no, I think this is far too new to say that there's a single point of responsibility in the organization. And typically not IT audit, thank God, but somewhere either between the security team or the one poor schmuck that's in charge of AppSec, or maybe the dev leaders or dev persons.
Yeah, it's a shift though. Would you say there's a shift? Yeah.
I say there's a shift. It is shifting to be more part responsibility of the dev organizations, or organic. And I think that's, you know, probably you could say that about software security AppSec in general, is the more mature organizations have that already as part of their dev team. They've gone beyond AppSec champions. I'm not going to use the term shift left. They have put this as part of their processes. And basically it is, you know, another facet of software quality. I think we all everyone wins when software managers, software developers view security and resiliency as just another facet of quality. Hmm.
No, big time. And I think you're to that point, right? I think it's more use driven these days now, right? Things are getting forced together. I love that pantry analogy, by the way, because that actually came home for me the other day when I brought out a cast iron pot for a while. For the first time in a while, I was going to do some reverse searing on a good barbecue, and I needed that. But I also needed a nice olive oil for the base. And, you know, we had that buried somewhere in a pantry. And my wife was the only one who actually knew where it was.
That's a different problem. Yeah,
that idea, right, of somebody in the org knows, hey, we're using that component. And, oh, yeah, we use this for that case, but nobody else does, right? And it's only when you've got a use case that forces you to leverage that component that suddenly it becomes important. But we're seeing that, because things are so collaborative now, we're seeing that kind of behavior where you have to know, right?
If you talk about collaboration and shared responsibility, throw in the turnover aspect within organizations, turnover. Let's just say, for argument's sake, I think the numbers that I have pulled are anywhere from 20 to 30%. And particularly now during this great downsizing mechanism. I mean, you have a lot of people that simply don't know what happened before. I did, this is now like maybe 8 or 9 years ago, some AppSec training surveys about gauging the effect of security training on developers. And this, I did it to two different OWASP conferences. So I'm going to say 2014, 2015, if I remember correctly. But one of the things I found out just through research was, sure enough, the developer turnover at the time was substantial, 20 to 30%, depending on the organization, worse in Silicon Valley and Austin and places like that. So whoever you trained 1 year, 2 years later was probably a different team, mm-hmm. right? So then like the tribal knowledge or the conventional wisdom of what lives where and what does what to whom, they don't know that. So yeah, it doesn't exist in many organizations.
Wow.
Yeah, I have a curious question, something that comes up a lot in AppSec anyway. Well, it's two-parter. First, for those of us who might not know what an SBOM even refers to or what it means, it'd be good to go into that a little bit. But secondly, we talk a lot about finding out what you're using, how it's being used, basically reporting on usage, stuff like that, and then being able to action it if it's a problem. So my question, I guess, would be, do we see a lot of these quote-unquote advanced or really good companies just doing the reporting aspect, or are they actioning on, say, when something like Shellshock comes out, like, oh my God, the world's on fire, I got to fix this now, yesterday kind of thing. Do they action it and have something in place to both generate the list and then check to see if that list has any new problems, as it were?
Okay, let me see if I can, let me define SBOMs for the lay people on the podcast. First of all, software bill of materials. It's essentially all the components and then the components that have subcomponents that exist within one software. And the nature of software now is software is built by cobbling together different components and then writing custom code on top of it. Nobody just writes their own TCP/IP stack or their own open SSL components. They don't do that. They're modules. They just go kludge it together, put it together. The challenge is that I think this wasn't really an issue or that you heard regularly within the enterprise 3 or 4 years ago. It is now one that's, you know, certainly front of mind for everybody. But I think what I've observed personally is that organizations are all over the place. The ones that have large federal contracts that are doing product are probably very close to it. You know, are looking at Section 4 of the EO and the subsequent things that have come out of the government that have further defined what that looks like. They're quite good because it's essentially a compliance activity that they have to do because they're selling so much to the federal government. If you look at that at one bookend, and then let's look at another industry like the oil and gas industry, which is, you know, kind of big in the Texas back area that I live. They have other drivers, and that's where you're likely to see the big buyers affecting behaviors around SBOMs and software supply chain more generally. So if Shell or Exxon or BP, the what they call the majors, the real big ones, say thou shalt do this, then you have all their suppliers, all the supply chain people below them doing it. And we've seen that happen and drive more behaviors than anything like the federal government stuff. So I would say my observation is it's all over the place at this point. They know about it. They're in different kind of levels of maturity, but the ones that have direct supplies to the government are probably way ahead of everybody because they have to be.
It's interesting. You would always expect the free market to be quote unquote more efficient or faster or better at stuff like this that are requirements than say the government entity, but only after it gets a push in the right direction, so to speak. It's very, very interesting that the federally facing ones are quote unquote doing a better job of this. And just recently we're hearing about API usage as being a major component as opposed to just open source integration. You know, what with all the things that are coming out now, you just plug in a URL, you ask it a question and it gives you an answer. Is that URL safe or API safe in this case? So it's very, very interesting.
No, I'm there as well spiritually. One would assume, but you're talking to a guy that's been doing proselytizing about AppSec since 2005, and I still believe it's the least consumed of all the different security disciplines in a not good way. And what I mean by that is, I've, you know, gone in and done the pitch and we do this program. Hey, we looked at, you know, they did an open SAM assessment or BSIM assessment. They found out that they're all zeros or ones, yet their appetite to really throw resources at this was far less. And there's a variety of reasons for that. One of them is security leaders almost entirely by background, have more of a network or audit background. And so software security ends up, software in general is less understood. I would also argue that it's hard, and it's, you know, path of least resistance is to throw in a firewall, do network security stuff, things that are much more obvious, so to speak. And I think the markets reflect that. I think Gartner captures how big AppSec is versus some of the other security markets, and they dwarf AppSec. So so I believe that the external pressures are going to do more for AppSec than anything. When I mean external pressures, I mean, yeah, honestly, supply chain pressures like this. I would argue litigation is another one. I hate to say it. you know, the litigation risk, which wasn't an issue a few years back, is certainly one. And then just flat out regulation where you know, and that's unfortunate. I mean, but I'm telling you, and I think, Robbie, at least you know this, that I've been out there in certain instances doing pitching this since, you know, since AppScan was WatchFire. Before it was IBM, before it was HCL. I mean, and I just saw these arguments fall on deaf ears. So I think external pressures are going to change things in a way that that is good, but it's unfortunate. Like, you would think that people would do the right sets of things because they know the risk. And, you know, I put a lot of time into OpenSAM. Myself, Dan Cornell, a bunch of the other vendors back in the day to try to convince others to consume more AppSec services and products, right? And so the whole thought was, like, if you knew what your peers are doing comparatively, that's really what BSIM has in their back pockets. They got the comparative numbers. Then one would do more, right? I think that is borne out to not be the case, you know. And in a world where executive leaders have a array of business risks, this risk just ends up becoming a secondary, tertiary risk because it's less understood. And honestly, they have other big ones. And I'll tell one last war story. We're doing work for a oil field services company in Houston. And these are one of the companies that are, you know, do work for Shell, BP, Exxon. And I was talking about cross-site scripting and SQL injections to their CISO. And he's like, hey, that's cool, but I've got a bunch of crews in this place called Kirkuk in northern Iraq, which I know quite well. And there's this new group of folks called ISIS that are coming. We're worried about our crews that are up in northern Iraq. This is the pre-takeover of northern Iraq by ISIS. So he ended up having to get people in there to get these crews out. And so when you're talking to certain businesses, guess what? I'm worried about, you know, my oil field crews getting captured by ISIS.
Right.
Yeah. Or SQL injection.
Yeah.
It's just my pipeline in Kenya blew up, or cross-site scripting error. You know,
right.
Yeah. So that's what happens, is they're not dummies. They just have other risks that honestly probably they worry about more than they worry about the software side.
I did a presentation at the end of last year in Germany on continuous security, which is, it's talking end to end sort of thing. And I was surprised at the end of the presentation that there was so many people asking, how do you make good security champions? How do you make a program around that? And I would have thought in this day and age that would have been a very cemented thing. So it kind of surprised me that it's still a challenge for a lot of organizations. I'm just wondering what you're seeing in that space.
I think in that regard, that particular region is probably a laggard. I mean, behind. I don't know why. Maybe it's the hierarchical nature of German businesses, maybe. Mm-hmm. But I would say AppSec champions in the U.S. is way further ahead. As I mentioned to y'all before, I did a survey on this topic about 2.5 years ago. And the reason I did it is because I found just anecdotally that almost every program that we were in helping had an AppSec champions program. It's like, wow, okay. That there was some kind of correlation between goodness and AppSec champions program. Again, this was Denham Group, you know, late 2000 up to really 2020. very U.S. centric, North American centric, arguably. But like we saw it everywhere. And I think this is driven off of a lot of the OWASP proselytizing that happened in North America for a very long time. And it just kind of caught on here more so. The other issue is in the States, I mean, I think there's a much more risk acceptance approach, Wild Wild West approach. We're going to build software, we're going to do all this stuff, an appetite to build quickly. And the AppSec Champions programs, or the popularity of them, was really a coping mechanism where we looked up and suddenly, you know, there's thousands of devs and there's two AppSec managers responsible for software risk. Right. So it was a bit of a coping mechanism and less than ideal. A cool area though, because they do, one of the key findings I had was that these programs do in fact change behaviors, which is pretty cool. So, in a nutshell.
Yeah. No, and I think that's actually really cool. Cause you hear the term, building your security champions and having your program. I think Tanya Jenke gave a session around that a little bit this last, the keynote that she did in OWASP as well. I thought it was very cool out of that study, though, that it seemed like most of the organizations, I think you had said about 2/3 of them, had done it organically, right? That there wasn't this mandate from the C-suite or something like that, but they had built it up more out of necessity. And I think that, at least to me, was telling me that, hey, people do actually care about this. They just need to know what to do. Right, that there's that gap in it's not like any developer raises their hand and says, hey, I would love to deliver insecure software today that's going to be breached in the wild, right? But they don't necessarily know what they don't know, right? That kind of thing. So I'm curious, for the ones that are doing it well, kind of what are the things that make the difference? Are there kind of key metrics or things that you look for, stuff like that you can tell, hey, my program is actually healthy and humming pretty well, or gosh, maybe I need to think about doing this better.
Yeah. So there are a ton of metrics that one can capture. The first thing is you have to have a program that is just not tribal knowledge. You have to use things like newsletters, up-to-date Slack channels. You have to do things that are measurable, because you're going to do all these things and you have two or three people versus 300 or some great number. You have to be able to scale it. And that's a bit of a term. So I would say what we found out is that, number one, the good programs regularly communicated in structured and unstructured ways. And you can measure that. So that meant either a town hall once a month or a email newsletter, news blast once a week, but also Slack and Teams or some kind of way to talk. And you can measure all those interactions because at the end of the day, you have to be able to go to management and say, I need two more people to do this because I've done all these lead activities. Now, ultimately, what you want is you want to say, be able to show that the vulnerabilities per line of code went down. And what I've found is that, that by focusing on one or two teams, you can use them as kind of test cases or as prototypes. You can affect positive behavior many times with them, and then from there scale it. And what I mean by that is essentially a two-step thing. Instead of saying like, okay, I've got three people, I've got 80 dev teams. Instead of trying to boil the ocean and try to get three or four of them that really already get it, maybe, and are a little bit further ahead, and have an actual AppSec, a champion, a guy that female developer that went to college and got one or two electives in security. Get them as kind of starting points, and then show good behavior and show improvement with them. And then one thing that devs want to do is they also want to look good relative to their peers. And so nobody wants to be the dev team that sucks. So like if you can get and show some positive wins with them, either quantitatively or at least, starting qualitatively, get them to brag about it. That's where, some type of scoreboarding is helpful, any type of gamification that you can do at a certain point. But ultimately you want to be able to show less vulnerabilities per line of code, less vulnerabilities in that show up in pen tests or in assessments. That's an end goal, and that takes a while to get. Initially, you have to at least have a program that is positively received on the other end. And so that if the dev managers could say, is this helping or hurting me? Like a simple yes, no question for them is like, look, is this helping me? Are these guys consultants to me, helping me on this broad topic? Are they viewed as a gating function, which nobody wants? And so I think the broader thing right now is that the AppSec champions are using their expertise to help them and accelerate this program. Ultimately, the champions that are embedded in each of these teams do it for them. So it is, a managerial leverage concept that is, times 100 if you can do it. One little aside, one of the findings that we were able to come up with was we asked how many AppSec people did each team have and how many developers. And we were looking for some correlation or some commonality between the number of AppSec, FTEs, whatever employment status they were, versus developers, again, whatever employment status we had. And it came out to that the good programs, the programs that self-identified as mature or maturing, had either a ratio of 1-50 to 1-100. So for every AppSec person, there was 100 developers, or 50, somewhere in there, 50-100. That's not that bad. I mean, particularly we're talking 30 or, you have some organizations have 3,000 to 10,000 developers. What we were able to spot too is there was a couple that came out that we knew were not mature. And sure enough, they had 2 or 3 AppSec people for 10,000 developers. And so that's
the scale.
So 1-50 to 1-100. And I think one of the BSIM reports, recent BSIM reports also captures that number. So I think that's a good reference number to look at. And one that, again, if you're building a program, you can go to management and say, look, we think it's this. There's 2 different sources that say 1-50 to 1-100.
Does independence matter? Like separation of duties from the dev team so that they're aligned more to security sort of goals and ambitions and compliance, that sort of thing?
That was not a topic at all of the survey, but that's an interesting point. They are almost exclusively resident within the security teams. Everybody I talked to, they were on the security teams. I didn't ask about perceptions of, whether or not they're perceived to be a gating function or independent or anything, all the negatives you think about with security and audit. But that's a good, really good point. I don't think it ever came up in freeform discussions either. They all know who they are and they know what they want. It was just one key question that I didn't ask that I would do if I do one of these again, what's the perception of them? How are they helping? And sure enough, the financial organizations, as you might imagine, the banks were further ahead. Yes. Some of them, two of them specifically, 2 or 3 had AppSec champions programs that had been around for decades. Mm. So it's like, they've been around so many different times, they had 2 or 3 different managers over time. So that's kind of an interesting one. Mm. Now, I did one last point of given the turnover and things going on in the world right now is we found out unexpectedly that there were several programs that had major setbacks where they lost the person or persons responsible for managing AppSec champions. My going in assumption was that all these things are getting bigger and better and more mature and kind of going down a path and doing well, when in fact we found more than one. I think we had almost 40 that we talked to. One or more big company that said, no, they had a setback. They lost a key person managing it, and the program was a reset, or they went backwards. And so what that informs an AppSec manager of is the fact that these things aren't just going to grow on their own. They need a lot of care and feeding. They need wins. They need quantitative numbers to reflect those wins. And then ultimately, your success is when this stuff just becomes part of the dev process. Again, they do away with it because it's now – the security champion is like the UI UX person on the dev team. They're just to become part of that, what they build.
Yeah.
And there's a great point on that, on just culture, that I'm sure we could talk for a long time, which is great. But guys, for those who are curious about this survey that we're referring to, it's on the Coalfire website. You can get it from there. And if you're looking for a really good example, I always talk about the work that Jennifer Saplewski's done at Target. And she'll actually be speaking at, you know, when you're listening to this podcast, she'll be speaking at the RSA conference here in 2023 in a few months. That's should be sometime in May, if I remember right. Mm-hmm. So if you're attending that and are really interested in this topic around building champions, check out that session. So John, I am curious about one other thing that we talked a little bit about it, and you kind of hinted this right at the beginning. You're doing a lot there in the city of San Antonio around the airport and everything, and which is cool because I'm glad San Antonio actually has an airport. No, I'm just kidding. San Antonio. I love it. I was just trying to spur something there, no pun intended. But I'm curious how much of the work that we're talking about here, right, this supply chain security, champions and security, is that, are you seeing that kind of folding over into the work that you're doing with the airport as they're pulling that together and that kind of stuff?
No. However, what I think the commonality is organizational and more political and organizational, dealing with personalities, key leaders. There is a reason that San Antonio fell behind in its airport, and it was personalities and political leaders and councils and mayors and managers, city managers. There's a reason. And if you go back in time, you kind of like, what? And now we're you know, playing catch up is what it boils down to. And we have a mayor that said, this is going to be an important thing. And I got picked to do this 6 or 7 years ago because this is kind of silly. On Facebook, I would check. When I would go to the airport, I would check in and say, I'm going to so-and-so and going to this place or going to that place. And so I was I'm a million miler on at least two airlines, probably a third if Southwest had that on there. And so I was a connoisseur of airports and I knew a lot about, that's how I got picked as a security guy to do this. But I would say the common denominator is knowing how to work the organization to get what one wants to get done. And in this instance, we built coalitions. It wasn't just me, it was the committee that I chair, other key council members, the mayor, the city manager, and build essentially a shared goal of building a world-class airport in a city that really needs one. And so that was the background. But it's again, selling. I tell this to everybody in AFSEC. It's like, ironically, you're probably technical in nature, but you're really a sales and marketing person trying to get the developers to do on your behalf what they're not doing. And so it's, if you can sell, you can sell that, you can sell an airport, you can sell different other things. So, that's it. But no, it's been a cool project. It's been a passion play. The other thing for those that fly a lot, it takes about 10 to 12 years to really build a new airport terminal facility. And so we're at year 6 or 7 and we start break ground, I think early next year. So at some point it'll be cool. It's a cool project, has really nothing to do with AppSec or security, except for the human part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and those who are going through Los Angeles at any time recently, right, you know that there's massive work going on there too. And it's just taking forever trying to put the work in, but appreciate the effort there, which is pretty cool. So we'll have to check that out when we fly through. Is your name going to be anywhere? Will we have like, you know, brought to you by John Dixon somewhere in Terminal 3? Or...
Doubtful. No, nor am I asking for that. But no, it's kind of, the other thing is that if you're in this AppSec career field, you're not doing it for the glory either, right? I mean, you're kind of grinding it out. You have to be happy with outcomes that are, you know, the more group outcomes. And I think that's the case, is like my satisfaction will be when we have an airport that people brag about. And and so we'll get there.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah. So, I'll send you all an email, the design documents, which are pretty breathtaking.
It's pretty cool. Cool. Well, I have one other question for you, a slightly different topic, but I think, you know, given the conversations we've had at AppSec Cali and other places, right, this is becoming an area that a lot of people are getting interested into. And I work with some universities, got some capstone projects going on. Super grateful to Chris as well on this for some work that we've done with students, particularly at Arizona State on this. But we get asked a lot about, you know, what cert should I get and what should I do and how to... What would you say to this generation of students that are looking to get into the space? Like, what's important? What should they be keying in on? And what encouragement would you have for them?
I would encourage you, number one, because you'll be functionally employable at a high salary forever if you can get into the space, for starters. No, I'm being a little bit facetious. I would say, I think those that have done well understood core concepts around Unix, around TCP/IP, and around HTTP. They knew those areas cold, knew those areas of expertise, or in the case of AppSec people, they knew how to, they were great coders. So all the great security people that I know originally started out as sysadmins or coders and kind of morphed into it. And they knew it better than anybody. They knew it better than the offensive folks. So there's no easy button. That's why I'm comfortable with certs. Certs are kind of a cherry on top, and you can see it too when you see some of these folks that have come through and you look at the resumes and like, wow, they've done this, and they're this type of certification or that type of certification, and it's great. It's a good signal to the employers that they're serious, but it doesn't. You know, it doesn't substitute for deep knowledge and deep understanding about the subjects that we practice with. So I don't think there's an easy button there. I mean, if you can code, learn. And what I really found is the people that do well love it. And their hobby also happens to be this. They really enjoy it. They enjoy watching Mr. Robot. They enjoy reading books about it. They immerse themselves in it. And to be quite candid, the people that are passionate about it don't have to be told to do certain things. And that's what I think right now, the cert factories worry me, you know, a bit. The old joke about MCSE stands for must consult somebody else. That's true to some degree, where you've got certain certs where they've got this, and you ask them to do something and they don't know it. I'll tell you my litmus test for a technical interviewing was just get somebody to explain DNS up on a whiteboard, and not just the fact that it translates a domain to an IP address. We got that part. But like, explain DNS and how the DNS system works, because if you can understand how DNS works, then you kind of understand at least part of the problem, part of the challenge. That's my particular bias. It's probably old school, but the ones that are work for me or work with me that were really, really good at this, just really knew it deeply, you know, and or had a lifelong learning, you know, habit. So,
wow. Yeah, it's very rare that a day goes by that I don't see somebody on Twitter go, it's always the DNS.
So. I don't know. I mean, again, that's I backed my way into this. I was an intelligence officer, and for 3 years after Desert Storm, went around helping with a team to fix everything that broke out there, and almost all of it broke during Desert Storm. I mean, when I say it, I mean the systems. So I ended up learning Unix because we had to. We were on deployments and things where we had to know Unix. So we backed our way into it, but once we knew it really, really well, and because we had to administer systems. I was the least qualified of our group to do it, but I had guys around me that did it exceptionally well, in spite of the fact that they were, you know, non-CS degreed enlisted guys that just picked it up organically. All of them have gone off to have marvelous careers in security. I throw that out there. So.
Oh, there he is. Yeah, I was going to say, it's important to note that learning never stops. I've been doing this for almost well over 10 years now, and I still find things I need to look up, learn, and immerse myself in. So I think that's important. But my very serious question is, are there going to be any hidden tunnels in that new airport? I'm very, very curious. This we need to know.
It's like an answer in so many different ways. I'll just say this. It's, you know, how regions compete now, regions is through their airports, really. And so just remember that when you fly different places, that's how kind of how the regions differentiate themselves. And I would argue that other places have done a pretty good job and we're playing catch up. So, but then there'll be no tunnels.
Dang it. Supposedly. There'll be no tunnels.
I did see plans for autonomous baggage handling, which is pretty slick. There'll be autonomy throughout. And also one other big thing that's happening is autonomous last mile helicopters, essentially, that are now FAA is looking at, most of the airports are looking at. And even though they don't exist right now in a commercially available way, almost all the airports right now that are being designed are including some type of component for that. Think of, you know, an autonomous Uber, but a helicopter and not a car. So yeah, that's pretty cool too. So that is part of it, not the tunnels. So.
Oh, well, that's futuristic, I guess. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. But I mean anyway,
well, be a hell of a way to get to the car pickup, autonomous helicopter.
I saw a presentation by the design engineers, the engineering company called Corgan that did this. And they did the one at Dallas Love. They did that new terminal at Dallas Love. And they said from the time they started planning, they did a timeline of when Uber was founded and they started planning for the new Dallas Love. That was 2008. And they just went through the progression of Uber. Like Uber didn't exist when they started planning for this thing. So in that context, yeah, you do need to plan for the future and look at things that you think are coming down the pike. The one thing I'd say as a security person, it is absolutely true. And one thing I'm doing post coal fire is just hitting the books again. I mean, like what is the impact of machine learning and ChatGPT on our career field? What is, like maybe, you know, the network stuff pretty well. That's great. Fantastic. But now what does it look like in an AWS or GCP world? I say this, I'm passionate about it. I tell people that are lay people, you know, civilians, imagine if you're an accountant and if generally accepted accounting principles change every 3 years, or if you're an attorney and your statutory and case law just turned over every 5 years, like literally we are the career field that we, the area of technology in which we practice is at such changing at such a rate of speed. We have no choice but to do this.
John, this has been amazing. Thank you very much.
Can't
thank you enough. I mean, some great topics there. I mean, certainly ones that I'm very interested in as well. So really appreciate your insight. It's certainly.
Yeah, I'll send you that airport deal. And we should keep in touch. And
absolutely.
We're all, you know, band of brothers here and sisters that are trying to get these organizations to do the right thing before something happens. It's my career challenge. Do just enough so that they go after somebody else. You know,
like, yes. That should be on a t-shirt somewhere.
There you go.
Yeah.
Make sure John, you have to against all but nation states.
Yes. So John, anything coming up that you want to promote or talk to? You got any speaking engagements happening or places where people can catch up with you?
I'm thinking about going to RSA, and it's interesting, first time as a non-employee for anybody.
Wow.
So that's going to be, I mean, we go as a civilian or layperson. No, I'm just doing a lot of writing and reading right now, which I have just a ginormous technical debt of things that I'm going through. Month four after coal fire, I miss elements of it, but I'm, you know, right now I'm not catching up on everything else. I am now doing a lot of speaking and I will just say this interesting last thought. I have three different consulting opportunities, all of them that are not outside my non-compete with coal fire. But they're all interesting in that they have a common denominator with a particular nation state. And I'll leave that with you. I mean, nice. Like all three of them are wildly different. But the common denominator driving the consulting is a particular nation state that has gotten everybody's attention. So it's like, ooh, wow.
We'll leave that as the cliffhanger for
you. Yeah. You have to DM me or email me and find out what, which one that was. There's probably a 50% chance of getting it right.
I would have thought the percentage might be higher, but
yeah.
I'll just hint, it's not Iran and it's not North Korea. So there you go.
And it's probably not Antarctica either, just in case you're wondering.
Exactly. So gentlemen, it's been my pleasure. Well, I appreciate it. Colin, Chris, Rob, I hope to see you in the real world soon.
Absolutely.
Maybe somewhere.
Yeah.
Yep.
Hope to.
Well, thank you very much, John. Appreciate it.
Cheers.
That was a great conversation.
Cheers.
It's my pleasure.